Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of the College Debates and Discourse Alliance, which is a program that teaches students and faculty how to honor ideological diversity and foster civil discourse on college campuses. And she was at Utah State University recently to facilitate a campus dialogue on the question, how should our campus respond to controversial speakers? Sadie Webb works with students, faculty, and administrators to bring debate and dialogue programming to colleges and universities across the U.S. She graduated magna cum laude from Denison University, double majoring in international studies and political science with a concentration in foreign policy formulation. Throughout her undergraduate education, she was heavily involved in a variety of campus extracurriculars, including co-founding the Denison Debate Society. Sadie Webb, a pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Hi, good morning, Tom. Happy to be here.
Good morning. Thanks for coming on the program. We'll loop back to several of these other things just a little bit later in the program. I want to talk about the, I guess you could consider the elephant in the room. So last week you were on the USU campus?
Yes. I was on USU's campus, invited by the Harabi Peace Institute and the Institute of Government and Politics.
This, of course, is a couple of weeks after the murder of Charlie Kirk on the campus of Utah Valley University. Just a painful thing, obviously. Charlie Kirk was engaging in free speech, right, when he was murdered. The topic, apparently, that the UN students engaged in, how should our campus respond to controversial speakers. I guess maybe a starting point is how are the topics chosen when you come to campus?
Yeah, excellent question. So when we partner with college campuses, we really want to serve the needs of the campus community. And so the way that we develop topics is by partnering with students and faculty. So like I mentioned, we were invited to campus actually before the tragedy of Charlie Kirk's murder happened. And we were invited by the Harabi Peace Institute and the Institute of Government and Politics to come to campus and host a dialogue or debate event. But then what we actually do is we create a small group of student leaders on campus. So we worked with student leaders affiliated with both of those organizations that I mentioned. And we had a few brainstorming sessions, you know, what's important to talk about right now? And already students were saying, like, it's really important for us to talk about free speech and really important for us to talk about engaging with controversial speakers. They were hoping to create an event that would help set the tone for Kirk's visit to campus, right? Creating a space where voices were welcome and we could find ways to disagree respectfully and peacefully with those that had differing opinions from ourselves.
Yeah, that's interesting. So this was set up before his assassination. And of course, Charlie Kirk would come to campuses, right, and engage in dialogue. And so very timely topic. How did that change then after his assassination, this idea and the discussion?
Yeah, well, obviously, I can only speak on how the discussion went, right? I don't know how it would have gone had this tragedy not happened. But I think in light of the tragedy, there was a lot of nervousness and fear, but mostly healing that needed to be done, right? We had students coming to the event who were looking forward to going to the Turning Point USA event and seeing Kirk and engaging with him on campus, right? We had students come to the event who were just, you know, confused about what was going on, right? So really, I think the event became a space for students and faculty, right, folks on USU's campus to engage about a horrific tragedy that just happened, but in a productive way.
Was there healing, do you think? Was it productive? It's certainly national media. Is not that right? People retreat in generally people have retreated to their ideological bunkers and I wonder how the event was in that respect here at USU.
Yeah, I think that healing is something that takes a long time, right? And I in no way would suggest that one event has the capacity to solve a problem or heal after a tragedy. But it can be a starting point for people, right? And so we had a lot of really positive engagement and reaction from students after the fact. We had one student share with us, right? They were looking forward to Kirk's visit, and after this happened, they just didn't really know what to do. And so they were really grateful for a space to engage and start talking about this. And so we try and position our events as something that is a starting point for addressing problems, right? Not the solution, just a place to begin.
I want to talk about your, I guess, your sponsoring organizations. It's Braver Angels, right? And then something I hadn't heard of, ACTA, American Council of Trustees and Alumni. Did I get that right? And then Bridge USA. Tell me briefly about those. I've heard of Braver Angels. Tell me about these organizations.
Yeah, so we are a coalition of nonprofits. The three organizations you mentioned, Braver Angels, Bridge USA, and then ACTA, the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, where I actually work. And so the organizations are all equal share partners in the College Debates and Discourse Alliance. But when the alliance was formed in 2018, there was this recognition that each of the alliance partners has something different to offer and contribute, right? So Braver Angels has the Braver Angels debate style and format, right? Which is our flagship program offering and the style of debate that we actually host. Bridge USA has chapters all across the US. And so they really have a lot of expertise in engaging youth voices and mobilizing students on college campuses. ACTA is a much older organization than both Braver Angels and Bridge USA. And as an organization committed to higher ed reform, has a lot of experience navigating the higher education landscape. And so together, the three organizations are able to contribute their unique expertise to create a program that really, I would say, is effective at engaging with students, faculty, and staff, right, on all levels of campus.
Before we jump into how how one of these de debates or dialogues is put together and how it proceeds, which is different from a regular quote unquote debate, I want to have you have us take a minute and talk about hope, sadly needed, oh so needed. It seems like it, more and more polarization. And no matter what people like Braver Angels or Bridge USA do, and heaven bless all of you people, I sometimes feel like we're not making any progress at all. Hopefully, you can disabuse me of that feeling.
I think, Tom, the easiest thing for me to say is we have no other option, right? It is a place of privilege to give up hope, right? There are so many people in this country and in this world who just simply don't have an option. So I would almost ask you, what's the alternative, right? If we don't find a way to remain hopeful.
Very true. Very true. As I said before, we can all go home and get in a fetal position, but that seems to seems to be the preferred alternative sometimes. Or dig in deeper. That seems to be a position. You got to fight harder. We got to actually destroy the other side, right? I guess those are some other alternatives, right? But yeah, you're right. Let's not give up hope. So tell me how a Braver Angels debate, the debates of the kind that you, or is debate even the right word? Dialogue?
It
Debate
is.
is the word. So tell me how this proceeds versus a more stereotypical debate.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you asked debate versus dialogue. So the College Debates and Discourse Alliance has two different offerings. We have debates and we have dialogues. I'll talk about debate first. Debate is The debate that we do, it differs from traditional competitive debate, right? The debate that we do is non-competitive, non-performative, and invites everybody into the space to engage with one another on equal platform, right? We eliminate any hierarchy. We invite anyone and everyone into the room to share what they say, or to share what they believe, and we ask them simply, what do you believe and why on this topic? From there, we use an amended style of parliamentary procedure, which sounds like a mouthful, but is actually quite simple. We ask for folks to address the chair, the moderator in the room. We ask for folks to follow time restrictions, so we make sure that everybody has equal opportunity to share. And then, where this debate really differs from any competitive style of debate, in addition to being non-competitive, non-performative, is we end with a debrief session. And so we end the debate, we say, what do folks think of this experience? No longer what's your opinion on this topic, but what was sitting in this space and engaging with people you disagree with like? And that is something where I see a lot of hope come out, right? Where we see people have these transformative experiences saying, I'm more inclined to share my opinion now. I'm more comfortable sitting and listening to somebody with a different opinion. And so that debrief is really one of the, I think, key elements of our format. We also have the dialogue format. The dialogue format is very similar in function. However, it focuses around a solution-oriented question, whereas a debate question is a yes or no question, asking people to take a side so that we can really dig into and understand some of the polarization that exists around a topic. A dialogue is for questions that may be less polarized but are focused on solution-oriented, open-ended questions. The dialogue as well ends with a debrief period, and they're both run using very similar structures.
I'm reading your materials here at FAQ on your website. You say that this style of debate or dialogue encourages deep listening and respect. That's, of course, something, and I'm trying as we go along to broaden this out. You know, many of our listeners won't be on a college campus to be to one of these events. So how can we, follow these and practice these principles in our lives? So deep listening and respect, obviously important. How do we get there? How do you get the students there?
Yeah, excellent question. So that's where our format comes in, right? The way that we cultivate deep listening and respect is we start by opening the event and saying, this is what the expectations for engagement throughout the event are. One of those being listen to truly listen. But then the format itself helps to cultivate deep listening and respect because we take speakers, and after speakers share, we have the opportunity for people to ask questions, right? We don't have the opportunity for people to respond and say, great, Tom, thanks for sharing, but this is what I think, right? We really try and keep the conversation focused around what one speaker has said, right? Exploring their ideas, maybe challenging their ideas in some capacity, but keeping it focused on what that individual has said before we then move on to the next speaker who can share their ideas. The way that this cultivates deep listening and respect is it forces people to engage with one another's ideas as opposed to just sitting, waiting for somebody to be done talking and then saying, great, now this is what I think, right? Because I think that's what happens in, debate occasionally is people talk past each other because they're so excited to just share their own ideas and provide their own commentary on the subject.
What would you say, of course, the parliamentary style and the trained facilitators, I don't know if you call them facilitators, like you yourself would go in here.
Moderator,
Okay,
facilitator,
yeah.
chair.
How could I or our listeners develop this in just personal conversations, and I guess I want to speak to another thing I know you try to foster is that we're discussing, we're talking in good faith. And again, that's sadly absent in so much dialogue today in the nation. How do we get there? How do we practice that?
So They're separate questions, but they're connected. The first part, how do you practice this at home? You listen to truly listen. You come from a place of good faith and what that means is coming from a place of genuine curiosity and coming from a place of wanting to deepen your understanding of what the person you're engaging with is saying. Instead of trying to catch the person you're engaging with in, a fallacy or an aha, gotcha moment, ask them why. Why do they believe what they believe, right? What experiences have they had that have influenced their perspectives on this issue, right? Come from a place where you're trying to really understand their point of view before you start sharing your own point of view. I think the other big tip that I would have for practicing this in your day-to-day life is get comfortable being uncomfortable. When we hear things that we disagree with, our immediate reaction is to kind of shell up, close up, and go inward, or go on the defense. And when we get defensive, we distance people from the conversations, right? We alienate one another, and it becomes so much harder to foster that understanding. And so, if you're able to sit with your discomfort and recognize, I might completely disagree with what somebody is saying, but if I'm still safe in this moment, I can persevere and understand why they're sharing this, it's going to lead to a better understanding for both parties, right? And help to cultivate that respect that is necessary to combat polarization.
And I suppose both parties or all parties are going to have to agree. It's going to be good faith. It's going to be respect, right? Be
Yes,
because
absolutely.
if one of those parties goes to bad faith, I imagine it all breaks down.
Absolutely, right? This is something that in your individual life you have to navigate on a case-by-case basis. I would say always default to that, but don't put yourself in unsafe situations. And that's something that only you as an individual can decide, right?
Let's take a brief break. We'll be back with more with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of College Debates and Discourse Alliance. She was on Utah State University's campus recently to facilitate a campus dialogue with the question, how should our campus respond to controversial speakers? We'll have more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking today with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of the College Debates and Discourse Alliance. And she was on the Utah State University campus recently. She works with students, faculty, and administrators to bring debate and dialogue programming to colleges and universities across the U.S. Sadie Webb, I guess if you feel safe or safe-ish, I guess, then you're more likely to feel like you can dive into controversial topics, right? One way that a lot of us protect ourselves from any of that kind of conflict is we follow the old rule, don't talk about religion or politics, right? Shy away from, don't bring up anything controversial, right? But that doesn't really get us. To really bridge us to where we need to go.
Yeah.
Is that what happens in these dialogues and debates? Do students feel like they can open up and talk about controversial topics?
Yeah, they really do, Tom. We encourage all of the events that we do to or we excuse me, we encourage students to lean into the disagreement and the controversy. So, like I mentioned, all of the topics that we use for debates and dialogues are developed by student leaders on campuses. And when we're having those conversations, developing the topic, we encourage them to lean into the most controversial the issue there is, right? Say the thing that people are scared to say, address the elephant in the room, because if not in this space, where's it going to happen?
What kinds of topics have students gone to?
Anything and everything. We have had at this point close to 500 events. That's over 250 campus debates, over 150 classroom debates, and over 40 of the new dialogue programming. And the topics that they're on are varying. We've talked about abortion, we've talked about gun control, we've talked about healthcare, Israel and Palestine, free speech, the development of AI, transgender athletes. Transgender athletes competing in sports, right? Anything and everything, we find a way to talk about it.
Have you ever had an instance where you had to kick somebody out or disruptive?
No.
So people who attend, I guess they understand this needs to be in good faith.
Yeah. And so we open up all of our events with a sort of monologue, a short monologue from the chair or the moderator. And that is to set the tone of the event, right? It's welcoming people in and also saying, this is the expectation for engagement. And the power of social pressure is impressive. When you start an event by saying, this is how we're going to engage with one another, and you yourself behave in the way that you would like to see others engage, people are pretty quick to follow suit, even when it's talking about something where there's a lot of emotion and passion and intensity.
And I guess we could simulate this in our personal conversations. We'd invite someone. I would like to have a discussion with you. Here are the parameters. Do you agree? I guess that could be an adaptation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So do these debates and dialogues tend to sort themselves red, blue, or do people sort of get to greater nuance?
So we are focused on bringing folks together with a variety of ideas. And so one of the ways that we decide on the topic is we actually run polls, right? And we select topics that have the greatest division possible. And so we want to find something where folks are interested, but also where they're divided. Most of the time, but I would say much of the time, they are in their spaces where folks are divided, pretty 50-50 red blue, but also thinking about the landscape of college campuses, that's not always the case. It's really interesting to me, though, what we've seen time and time again is even on campuses that are more homogenous in ideology, we can basically always find a way to split the room. As we talk
Yeah, go
with
ahead. Go
folks,
ahead.
I was going to say, as we talk with folks, though, and folks share in those spaces, we do see there's a lot of nuance that comes out. And so, as people engage with one another and listen, people often have more in common than they think they do.
So how do you bring that out? I guess another adaptation question. How can I bring that out in conversations with that I guess myself first, right? And how can we get to more nuance? Just talking amongst ourselves.
Yeah, I think the best way to bring more nuance into your conversations is, again, to try and have conversations where you're really focusing on deep listening and respect, and not only sharing your own opinion, but creating space for the person you're engaging with to challenge your opinion, and then doing the best job you can of actively listening, engaging with what they're saying, taking a step outside of your own personal thoughts and beliefs and asking somebody, why do you believe this, right? Why do you think what you think?
And that can be kind of scary to be open to the possibility that you might not have it completely correct, right? To open the op opportunity
Absolutely.
to change your mind. And sometimes we don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think it can be scary. I also think it's essential. Intellectual humility is absolutely essential on our college campuses, but it's also essential in our day-to-day lives because that's how we grow as individuals and that's how we grow as a society. Our ideas by themselves are often wonderful, but they gain momentum and they become more nuanced and are strengthened when they receive feedback and engagement from others.
I'm wondering what the what's the overall goal of what you do. I could see a, maybe a grand plan. Let's go to college campuses. Let's train as many students, or at least expose as many students as we can, young people as we can, to this better way of dialogue, right? And that, not to say that the older generation's a lost cause, but let's raise up a generation that's more comfortable with this kind of dialogue.
I mean, I think the answer is in the question, Tom. The goal of what we're doing is to create, it's twofold, right? To create college campuses that really honor ideological diversity and foster civil discourse. But then from that, to create and cultivate student leaders who will then become social leaders and carry the movement forward. When I say social leaders, I don't mean, we're trying to indoctrinate people and have them push one ideology forward, but instead individuals within our society who are willing to engage with one another and have the hard conversations in a respectful and productive way, so that we can ultimately, hopefully, reduce the rancor in politics and reduce some of the toxic polarization that we see in our country.
There are powerful incentives toward polarization. You know, you can see those among our politicians, media. You know, you get more clicks with anger a lot of times, right? And even personally, I guess you there's a little thrill that comes with owning the other side, right? Very, very short lived, right? But a little thrill there. I want to frame the question this way: the students that you interact with. And I guess they're self-selecting, right? They're coming seeking something, and the people who enjoy polarization are not going to come to your event, maybe. But what are the incentives? How can we strengthen the incentives on the other side? How can we counteract the incentives to polarization? Because there are some.
And so when you say the other side, do you mean?
You mean your side? I mean what the work that you're doing, right? Depolarization.
Yeah. It's a good question. I think that there are incentives, if that's what you want to call them, for polarization, but I would ask you and folks listening to consider who those really serve, and who the mechanisms of polarization serve. We are less effective as a country when we are divided. And so if we find we have to find ways to come together and reduce polarization so that we can maintain the success of our country and maintain the well-being of everybody in our country. But the reality is we have different opinions, we have different ideas, and so we have to find a way to navigate those with one another. And so, similar to your question about hope, I would ask, what is the alternative? I don't think there is an alternative, because we must find a way to peacefully coexist. And yeah.
I want to ask you about, you've talked about this a little bit before. I want to have you expand on this. The title of the one of the organizations is Braver Angels, right? Takes some courage to step into this arena because you might get hurt, at least emotionally. How do we, I guess the students that you work with, it does take a bit of courage, right? How do you see them navigating this? That I imagine they come in kind of tentatively. Hey, am I going to put on my armor again here, or are we actually going to have an open dialogue?
Yeah, I would say it does take courage to do what we're asking folks to do. And also, students are incredibly capable, and they're showing us and people across the nation that courage is possible, that hope is possible. We are seeing a growing demand for our program, right? Interest is rising very rapidly from student leaders, as well as faculty and administrative leaders on campus. And so what we're seeing is that students, faculty, and staff want these spaces. I love that you mentioned the word like bravery. Something that we're actively trying to do is reframe the concept of safe spaces to one of to our program being one of brave spaces, right? Encouraging people to have that bravery, have that courage to engage with people they disagree with and share their opinion openly, honestly, and respectfully. And what we're seeing is when we give students, faculty, staff, community members the opportunity to do that, they rise to the occasion.
That is very helpful. I was reading that at least in the debate format, you have anybody who's going to participate do a bit of research, or is that maybe in the maybe a college classroom setting, but that you encourage them to research all sides, right? Don't just research the side that you agree with.
Yeah, so that's within the classroom setting. We have our curricular toolkit, and we're actually about to release our curricular toolkit version 3.0. And so the curricular toolkit was developed by faculty for faculty to enable them to implement debate and dialogue programming in their classrooms. And so this has really become a pedagogical tool for them. What we see within the curricular toolkit is a variety of assignments that faculty can use if they would like to help prime students for the conversation so that those conversations that are happening within the classroom are backed by research and solid information. Within the campus-wide events we do, if folks want to do research beforehand, of course that's encouraged, but it's not a requirement, right? The requirement is showing up. That's the hardest part, showing up and sharing what you believe and sharing with people why you believe it.
So I guess a way to adapt this idea, if you're not going to be in one of the programs that you administer, is, and I do tell students that I work with all the time, don't just be in your silo, right? And I have to tell myself that sometimes, right? Don't get out of your silo, right? Read some things that are opposing to what you to what you believe in, because that does widen the scope, doesn't it?
It does. It does. We all are so comfortable within our own silos, but we don't get an accurate understanding of the world and of our country if we stay within our silos. And so we have to actively work to break down those barriers and consume media, consume information that is outside of those silos that we're in.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with our final segment with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of College Debates and Discourse Alliance. It's a program that teaches students and faculty how to honor ideological diversity and foster civil discourse on college campuses. She was at Utah State University recently. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of the College Debates and Discourse Alliance. She was on the USU campus last week, and they were fostering a dialogue on the question, how should our campus respond to controversial speakers? That's, heavy and poignant because that was prepared before Charlie Kirk was assassinated. And took, as we talked about earlier, later, early in the program, took on a different hue in the wake of that assassination. So, Sadie Webb, I want to just quote a couple of people here. You did a podcast with some folks at Juniata College. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah.
Juniata College. I'm not sure where that is.
Juniata is one of our wonderful partner campuses, and they're in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, yeah. So you had gone there and done a campus event, right? In classroom and a bigger event as well.
Yeah.
And so you had a couple of professors and some students that you talked with. I just want to quote them and then maybe have you expand on other students that you've worked with. This is Maddie, a student at Juniata. I feel like, especially when you slow down and you have time to hear other people out, and you're not jumping them with questions immediately and honestly providing a personal attack, which is often what you see in media, I feel like it's a lot more productive in the sense that you're not arguing the person, you're arguing the topic, and you're arguing your own personal beliefs, rather than standing up there for an hour like a presidential debate where they just yell at each other and make fools of themselves. It's more civil between everybody in the room. So, Maddie gets it, right? Tell me about other students that you've worked with.
Yeah, I mean the students that we worked with at Juniata are absolutely incredible. We have wonderful faculty partners there as well. But Maddie's sentiments do a great job of encapsulating what most folks tend to share within the debrief period. And so the podcast that we recorded, I think a few years ago at this point, following two campus event or two classroom events and then a campus event with Juniata, is really reflective of the experience that folks have, right? I think for young people especially, there is so much interest in having dialogue, but many of us don't have the opportunity or haven't had the opportunity to engage in it. I think about my own experiences, and I was, able to grow up in a politically divided household where conversation and civil disagreement was the norm. But for so many of my peers, that wasn't the norm, and the only opportunity for political engagement and political disagreement is one that happens online, and that's just not productive, right? Most of what happens online is hateful and mean and not actually civil discourse. There's a lot of wonderful things that happen online, but it's different from that in-person interaction, those deep conversations that invite people in to really foster this deep listening, respect, and try and cultivate understanding about these complex and nuanced issues that just can't be encapsulated in a 10, 20, 30-second soundbite.
Do you, I guess a tangent here, but as you interact with these students, do you feel like they're media literate? Do you feel like they get, I guess you'd expand this to you and me, right? And everybody, we have to be media literate these days. There's so much disinformation out there. I guess speaking of the perspective of the students that you work with, do you think they get it? Do you think they know where to go to find accurate information?
I hope so. I think that it's increasingly challenging. I think that the students we engage with are incredibly thoughtful and well-spoken. Many of them are well-researched, but the reality of media literacy is it is an ongoing skill that we all have to practice.
I want to quote from one of the professors at Juniata College. He said, "I'm a father of a 14-year-old and a 9-year-old, and it's about putting your strengths in front of your weaknesses." And I don't think our students hear that enough. I thought that was profound. Another way you could talk about this is accentuating the positive rather than the negative, right? And that's so important. That's part of what you're doing, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. You asked earlier about the nuances that unfold in the conversations that we have. And what I've seen time and time again, at this point, I've moderated and led over, I think, 65 different events and on a variety of topics. What I've seen is we're less divided than we think we are. Even with the most contentious of topics, people generally want similar things. They want to be safe. They want to be healthy. They want their friends and family to be safe and healthy. They want access to basic resources. It's just how we get there, where people start to have these differing ideas and differing opinions. And so creating spaces where people can share those differing ideas and opinions on how to achieve what so many of us are looking for is really powerful.
I want to talk a little bit about your personal experience. You were in your bio that I read at the beginning. You co-founded the Denison Debate Society. I imagine that was kind of the that wasn't this what you're doing now is more conventional debate you were involved in.
So it was more conventional competitive debate, but This work is something that has been important to me for my entire life. And I didn't realize when I was younger that this work was something that was important to me. But growing up and as I've gotten older, I've realized that the experiences that I've had directly impact my passion for this work. So I mentioned I grew up in a really politically divided household. I'm a first-gen college student. And so when I got to campus at Denison University, I started engaging with my peers and realizing that so many of them didn't have the experience that I had. They didn't have the experience of sitting down at the dinner table with their mom and dad, and for me, my grandmother, and having a conversation where people disagree and tensions might rise, it might get heated. And then we say, okay, well, let's take a breath and we'll come back to this later. Let's agree to disagree, or let's circle back to this, and now let's sit down and have dinner together. And that's something that has been really, really formative for me, realizing we have to engage with people that we disagree with, and we can coexist with people we disagree with.
So I guess in the end, that was a good example for you guys because of the way your parents and grandmother were able to handle it. So many are not able to handle it that way, right? What
Yeah.
do you think enabled them? I guess there's sometimes sharp disagreements, and then they would say, "Okay, that's over. Let's eat." Is that what would happen?
Pretty much,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you as a child, how did obviously this sent you in a positive direction, I guess, but I guess if it had been more divided, more heated, right, long term, if they hadn't been able to say, okay, let's now sit down and eat dinner, then that might have affected you differently.
I'm sure it would have. But I think that the so my father and my late grandmother are on or were on polar opposites of the political spectrum. And I grew up having conversations with both of them at the same time, watching them have conversations, engaging in disagreement with one another, but then also having conversations with them individually. And in those conversations with them, I realized that despite their disagreement, there was still love for one another. Despite their disagreement, there was still great respect for one another. And that respect is something that we're really trying to cultivate in the work that we do. And something that I try and cultivate in my day-to-day interactions, recognizing that even if I disagree with somebody, they're entitled to their opinion and they're another human being that deserves my respect and my genuine curiosity and deep listening to try and understand where they're coming from, even if it might be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, it's very worthwhile work. Glad you're doing it and other people in your organizations. We've been talking with Sadie Webb, Associate Director of the College Debates and Discourse Alliance. How do people contact you if they're interested?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're interested in learning more about our work, please feel free to check out our website, goacta.org/initiatives/college debates. You can also just Google the College Debates and Discourse Alliance. We've got social media, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you're also welcome to find me on LinkedIn and connect, reach out personally. We'd love to hear from you.
And I'll plug Braver Angels, of course, one of your sponsoring organizations, braverangels.org, right? And then bridgeusa.org, a couple of organizations that if you're not going to be on a college campus, maybe you're older, you can connect with, especially Braver Angels for older folk. Bridge USA is for younger people as well, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So either which way, urge you to find one of these organizations and get involved and be part of the solution, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Sadie Webb, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Really lovely chatting with you.
Yay, thank you. Thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. It's one of the most amazing times of conjunctions of space events going on right now, all in the south. Well, not all of it, but as we dive right out of September into October already, fall is evident with leaves turning yellow, orange, and red in the foothills, mountains, and canyons, and the temperatures dropping as Earth sends quenching rains at times, even as a fire burns in the foothills above my humble abode and thankfully gets put out by the end of the day. And in the dusk and nighttime, the waxing crescent moon crosses Scorpius on its way to a meeting with Saturn as the moon's own sunrise line unveils more and more lunar features for viewing. October's a good month for moon watching, with Bella Luna showing off Copernicus Crater in Oceanus Procellarum. Visible to the naked eye, it becomes stunning through a telescope with terraced walls, a central peak, and rays extending hundreds of miles. This is one of the best times to see this in this time of the month. Thanks to Daisy from space.com, where moon magic follows with a crater that sticks out with the naked eye. I bet you've seen it before. Kepler, a small but striking 20-mile-wide crater gleaming west of Copernicus in the dark plain of Oceanus. Its sharp rim and bright ejector rays make it visible without magnification. Wow, what a sky, and it doesn't stop over in the southern direction. Along with the moon, Saturn and Neptune pair up with it on a nearly full moon on Sunday night. Whether you're gazing with your naked eye, binoculars, or exploring lunar geology through a telescope, there's plenty to enjoy in this week's skies. Check out the moon map and other charts, photos, and information on the Skywatcher Leo T site, and be sure and check out the Insider newspaper in southern Utah in every post office box. Also flashing through the skies of our solar system in this same area of the sky is Comet 2025 R2, known as the Swan. Swan has been making an appearance in the southern hemisphere. Thanks to Astro Brett for the tip on this from an article by Michael Martin. In mid-September, this comet came closest to the sun, and an outburst brightened the Swan greatly. Earthlings in the southern hemisphere have been seeing some incredible images as the comet swings past Blue Spike and Mars in the south, and now it's our turn in the northern hemisphere. We should start seeing the comet about 45 minutes after sunset in the southern skies tonight. Riding low on the horizon, traveling through Libra, and appearing close to one of my favorite stars, Zubinel Ganubi. To find it, look for Mars and Spiker over here, 45 minutes after sunset again. Low in the southern skies, get out the binoculars, and as the sky darkens, the word is the comet should eventually pop out. We'll have to see. And as apparently the year of the comet continues, while the Swan comet is in our field of vision, it is actually not physically near Mars. But our other favorite comet, Comet 31 Atlas, or 3i Atlas, is actually physically near Mars in the same area of viewing for us from Earth. Atlas comes from the center of the galaxy as its chemical aurora glow is changing from red to green. Scientists from the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile are observing. You can see an image of 31 Atlas shared by the European Space Agency and NASA. The ESA is redirecting their Mars Express orbiter, which is of course around Mars, to get a closer look to view this one close up, see if the aliens are running their mothership there. It'll be during the comet's closest approach to Mars, which is about right now, according to my information, on October 3rd. Well, all right, let's go. Also in this same area, southeast to southwest of the sky, where in this amazing time, two comets are visible, Saturn, Mars, Venus, Jupiter. We can also view Ceres, the largest dwarf planet in the asteroid belt, which is located by using two finger widths to the upper right of celestial west of the medium bright star Eta Ceti, you know, that one in Cetus the whale, with far brighter Saturn shining well to the upper right. Ceres will be ascending the southeastern sky during evening and then reach its highest elevation and best observing position when the due south of the planet is around 1 a.m. local time. So let's have a comet, planet, moon, star party. One sky, many cultures on Skywatcher Leo T. In ancient Roman religion, Ceres was a goddess of agriculture, grain, crops, fertility, and motherly relationships. She was originally the central deity in Rome's Aventine Triad, and was paired with her daughter in what Romans described as the Greek Rites of Ceres. Her 7-day April festival of Cerealia included the popular Ludi Cerealis, or Ceres Games. She was also honored in the May Lustrario of the fields at the Ambarvaya festival of harvest time. She's usually depicted as a mature woman. Next week, we'll check in on the Artemis II crew and what's going on with that heat shield. So keep looking up, look around, get a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.